You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, just after midnight last night, hundreds of people gathered under Seattle's Space Needle to light up joints. Space Needle? Spaced? Get the pun? Yeah? Okay. This is the official blowing up of Nixon's failed drug war. Millions of people in prison, billions of dollars spent, tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of lives destroyed. Tens of thousands of people certainly killed over this down in Mexico, not killed by the pot itself. Pot has never killed anybody. Alcohol kills 50,000 people a year. Pot has never killed anybody in history. But apparently, anyway, this is so the Washington State's new law took effect today. And Colorado's going to follow suit on January 5th. And last night when they signed, let me get the number of years here. It was the anniversary of the prohibition of alcohol being repealed in 1933. So that's an interesting story. It's going to be interesting to see how Washington State figures out how they're going to. Apparently, they're looking at a 25% tax. And, you know, how do you do that when people can grow it in their backyard? Are you going to have, you know, licenses like they have for people who make wine and beer at home? I mean, how's this going to work? And what might your thoughts be on that? Meanwhile, Bob Costas is getting grief on top of grief on top of grief. How dare he do what Barack Obama and Mitt Romney were afraid to do, which is utter this three-letter word in public, gun, or if the four-letter word, guns. What is the right time to have a conversation about guns in America? Apparently not now. I mean, you'd think that Bob Costas had gone on the air and advocated infanticide. You know, let's just burn babies in big piles. I mean, people are just hysterical. And, you know, basically what he said, I'll quote him. He was quoting, by the way, Jason Whitlock, a writer, a Kansas City-based writer who is very often on Fox Sports, who said, quote, "Our current gun culture ensures that more and more domestic disputes will end in the ultimate tragedy, and that more convenience store confrontations over loud music coming from a car will leave more teenage boys bloodied and dead. Handguns do not enhance our safety. They exacerbate our flaws, leading us to escalate arguments and bait us into embracing confrontation rather than avoid it." And then he went on to say, "In the coming days, Jovan Belcher's actions and its possible connection to football will be analyzed, but who knows? But here is what I believe. If Jovan Belcher didn't possess a gun, he and Cassandra Perkins would both be alive today." Well, with us on the line, Alan Corwin, the author and publisher, Second Amendment supporter, his website, gunlaws.com. And Alan, welcome to the program.
Nice to be back with you, Tom.
Glad to have you back with us. And by the way, I'm sorry, it says author. I don't have the title of your most recent book.
My last book is After You Shoot, Your Gun's Hot, The Perp's Not, Now What?
Okay, That's a great title, actually.
Well, look, if Cassandra had a gun and shot this guy twice in the chest, would Costas have gone on the TV and said, "Thank God she's alive and she stopped this murderous thug"?
Well, apparently she did have a gun, or she certainly had access to it. She and Jovan used to go shooting together. So having a gun in your hand at the moment you need it, as you well know, Alan, are two very different things.
I know. Well, under Bill Clinton, the Justice Department found that 3.4 million crimes and lives are saved every year by firearms. So do we stop those people
in the hands of police?
Is that the solution?
No, wait a minute. You're saying 3.5 million crimes are stopped and lives are saved. This is a statistic I have never in my life heard, and I've been doing this program for 9 years, and I've had all kinds of gun advocates on. I don't believe it. We have more gun murders in this country. We have more kids who are killed, you know, accidentally by guns than are killed intentionally by guns in all of Canada. I mean, it's obviously we have more population, but it's on a per capita basis, we have more.
Well,
we have a gun problem in this country, Alan. Why can't we talk about it in public? Why does Bob Costas get shot down like this? No pun intended.
We should, Tom. But the numerical arguments are tricky. Under Clinton, the Justice Department found 3.4 million defensive gun uses, DGUs. We sell a book that has 13 scholarly studies that find between 2.5 million and 700,000 defensive gun uses every year, depending on study size and time frame. So 2.5 million to 700,000 defensive gun uses. Should we look at this statistically, or should we look at it philosophically?
I think we should look at it intelligently and in terms of public policy. Why should – well, let me just ask this question, Alan, and this is a genuine – I'm not trying to play gotcha or anything here or trying to filibuster you. I'm sorry if it sounds like I am. I'll let you talk, certainly. But why should we say – you know, you have a right to public roads. It's in the Constitution. In Article 1, Section 8, Congress can raise taxes to build public roads. You have a right to be on a public road. Why should we say that you have to prove proficiency in order to move 6,000 pounds of steel down the road at 70 miles an hour, because it might kill somebody, but you don't have to prove proficiency to fire 45 grains of lead out of the barrel of a pistol at 747 miles an hour?
Well, let's take your first question. When is the right time to discuss guns? Halftime on football is probably not the right time to discuss abortion, jihad, saving your life.
Well, it might be the right time to discuss abortion if a football player had just, obviously it wouldn't be the case because they're men, but if they had just had a very high-profile abortion.
Well, how about jihad or any other subject? He'd take a lot of flack for that. So I would say halftime in a football game is the wrong time.
But one of the most famous football players in the country just committed a murder-suicide using a gun. I think it is entirely appropriate.
Halftime in football is not the right time to discuss complex social issues like abortion or jihad or the fiscal cliff or murder-suicide. He'd have taken a lot of guff.
Well, why is it that the guns never even got raised in the presidential debates?
Well, they did in the end, and I don't think they would have done well. Let's you and I spend an hour intelligently discussing this instead of 9 minutes.
We don't have an hour. Unfortunately, we only have 2 minutes left.
Let's take the question you just asked. If it's you have a misnomer here, a twist of logic. If it makes sense to register cars and teach people how to drive, then we should register airplanes and teach people how to fly. And
we do. I'm a licensed pilot. I can tell you all about it.
If it makes sense to register guns and teach people about guns and gun ownership, then we should register writers and teach people how to write and license writers.
I've never killed anybody with a typewriter.
Let me finish. First Amendment right to speak and write. Second Amendment right to own guns and protect your life.
The Second Amendment doesn't say to protect your life. It says to have a well-organized militia.
Well, it says to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
What are the first words of the Second Amendment?
I'll recite the 27 words if you want.
Just the first five.
We can parse this out.
In order to maintain a well-regulated militia.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Right.
Your right to own a firearm and your right to speak freely are fundamental rights. Should the government license your right to speak on the radio for you to
they
talk
do.
Publicly?
They absolutely do. I'm subject to all kinds of rules and regulations. There are words I could say that would cause me never again to be on radio by law.
And you think that's okay?
I think that's entirely appropriate, yes.
Would you be in prison for that?
I doubt I'd go to prison. I'd lose my radio show. But I think that you're drawing a false comparison. That's a straw man argument.
I defend my life, and I didn't take the class. I should go to jail? If Cassandra defends her life against this murderous thug, but she didn't take the class or have the paperwork, she's guilty of a crime? Can you support that?
No, he should have taken the class and done the paperwork.
And that would have saved him?
Well, it's not going to save everybody, but it's a step forward, and it's going to save a lot of children in this country who get killed accidentally by guns.
There's a video called No Guns for Negroes put out by Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Would you support that?
Oh, jeez. Alan Corwin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Gunlaws.com. We'll leave that as the last word, Alan.
I need to spend more time on this, Tom.
I think you're right.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school.
Cake. and proud.
It's our three, four minutes out of the week where I get to talk about one of my favorite topics, science. It's Thursday, so let's get geeky on some super smart sparrows. When we humans see cigarette butts scattered in city streets, we usually think of them as a nuisance or a public eyesore. But when those cute little sparrows see cigarette butts, they think to themselves, these are a great way to stay warm and ward off annoying pests. Seriously, those are the findings coming out of a study that was conducted at the National Autonomous University in Mexico. A team of researchers monitored 57 sparrow nests in Mexico City and found that the number of parasites and bugs in them decreased as the number of cigarette butts in each nest increased. Sparrow nests used in the study had between 0 and 38 cigarette butts in them, average of 8 butts per nest. According to the researchers in the study, the use of cigarette butts is an example of how sparrows and other species of birds learn. They adapt to living in urban environments. Nicotine is the main chemical found in cigarettes. It's a natural anti-parasitic byproduct of the tobacco plant. It's there to kill bugs. It's a neurological toxin, which is why people get addicted to it. It hits the nervous system. And it's been used for years as a pest repellent for crops and to help control parasites in poultry. The fact that sparrows use cigarette butts to ward off pets and to provide extra healing and cushioning to their nests, it's pretty cool in itself, but there's a bigger picture here as well. Animals are incredibly intelligent and far more intelligent than we often give them credit for. Take, for example, elephants that mourn the loss of their own. They actually have funerals. Or dolphins that plug their noses while scavenging on the seafloor. And if those examples aren't amazing for you, enough for you, listen to this amazing story about a group of lab animals. I had dinner with a friend two nights ago. He told me about his time as a lab assistant. One of his jobs was to inject TB toxins into the paws of hamsters. So one night he went into the lab to inject this hamster with TB. And he noticed when he walked in, all the animals in the room were going crazy, running around in their cages, making a lot of noise, which is normal. Actually, they weren't going crazy. This is just the normal thing. He went over to the hamster cage, pulled out the hamster. He flipped it over on its back, and he was getting ready to inject it when all of a sudden he noticed something. This room that had been filled with dozens of animals making tons of noise just moments ago had suddenly gone quiet. He looked around the room and noticed that all the animals were watching him. He put the hamster back in its cage without injecting it, left the laboratory, and never went back. Bottom line here is that as human beings, we need to reconsider the intelligence and sentience of the animals and living organisms around us. And that involves thinking about things like, where did that meat come from that you're eating? Does it come from a factory farm where the animals are packed together so tightly they can't even move? Or does it come from free-range farms where animals are allowed to roam freely and enjoy what little life they have? Bottom line, animals are smarter than we think, and we need to respect that. Okay, so that's my geek rant. Back to the guns. Glenn in Oakville, Connecticut. Hey, Glenn, thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Few points I want to make about Bob Costas, because I think he's taken a little too much heat over it. And I am a gun enthusiast, but at some time you got to talk about it. But he had every right because of it was just a football player that killed himself, killed his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then everybody forgets about Dave Dorson or Seau, Junior Seau. And then what about Plaxico Burress just a few years ago with a gun incident in a nightclub in New York City? Mm. You know, so I think he had a right because it had some sports background to it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that it was appropriate. And this whole thing about the Second Amendment gives you the right to defend yourself. It says in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, and the words well-regulated imply, if not specify, that somebody's in charge of that militia. And the rest of the Constitution makes it very clear that the militia of the United States is under civilian control. So we're talking about the right to basically have a gun in the armory of your local community or a gun that is part of the armory of your local community, if you want to read the Second Amendment rationally, in my opinion.
I don't know why everybody gets all upset when we talk about it. First of all, I mean, I have a pistol permit. You go, you buy a pistol, you have to give your permit, your ID. You go through an ID check. You walk out with it. If you're not someone in trouble, you walk out with a gun the same day.
Yeah.
Now, I don't see anything wrong with waiting 4 or 5 days for a gun, because if you're not going to use it for anything with criminal intent, then you're not worried about that.
Right.
So you wait 4 or 5 days, you come back, get your gun. I mean, maybe it would solve problems. Right. Everybody gets too uptight about this, like they're going to lose a right or something. I don't get it.
Yeah.
That's all.
I don't either. Thanks a lot, Glenn. Well said. Kamal?
Kamal?
Yeah. Hey, welcome to the program.
Kamal.
Kamal, thank you.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate it. I've been listening to you for a while.
Definitely agree with the last caller, and just also wanted to make a comment about this concept of being able to defend yourself if you have a weapon. And from my understanding from a lot of the instructors and police officers that I've spoken to, is that oftentimes people will try to use a gun to defend themselves, and the actual criminal or assailant will then take that gun and use it against them.
Right. That is actually I don't know if it's a more likely outcome, but it's a likely outcome.
Yeah, and they've said that it definitely happens more often than not, and it just flies in the face of this concept that, if they only had a gun, then this wouldn't have happened. And more likely than not, it actually ends up escalating the particular situation.
So. There you go. Well said. Kamel, thank you very much for the call. Dean in Pittsburgh, I got a minute of the break, Dean. It's all yours.
Oh, okay. Yeah, hi, Tom. The main point I wanted to bring up that I never hear anybody make about guns is how really useless they are for protecting your life. A gun can protect your property. I mean, if you've got a criminal with his back to you and he's trying to steal something from you, you can point the gun at him and say, stop right there, buddy. But when it comes to protecting your life, if somebody accosts you with a gun, they've got the upper hand. So to me, a gun has always seemed like an offensive weapon, not a defensive weapon. So the whole point about, well, people need guns for self-protection, and even the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence concedes that point. I'm not sure it's a good idea to concede that point, because the stats show
that's an excellent point. And guns also allow remote killing. I mean, that lead goes out there at 750 miles or 774 miles an hour, and it can go from 50 yards away, and so you could be killed by a gun and not even see it. So,
get away with it.
Yeah. Excellent point, Dean. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening, Pittsburgh. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. When do we need guns? I don't know. And how are we going to regulate marijuana? What are we going to do about this drug law, this whole drug policy? Oh, and Shelley Adelson is up to it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
He's coming to D.C. to talk to lawmakers. They say he's trying to buy the next election. I think he's trying to buy a law. Tell you about that. Okay, here's... Our last guest was saying 2.5 million defensive gun uses per year. That's interesting. And Shane Farnan, our associate producer here, did some digging during the break. Myths about defensive gun use and permissive gun carry laws by Daniel Webster, MPH, Master of Public Health, Johns Hopkins University, Baltimore, and Jens Ludwig, PhD, Georgetown University, Washington, D.C., this was published in 2000 by the Berkeley Media Studies Group. And what they tracked down was that there was these two guys, Gleck and Gertz, who made this claim that there are 2.5 million defensive uses of guns in the United States every year. In other words, 2.5 million times somebody pulls a gun and saves themselves from a crime. Now, they came to this number by telephoning 5,000 Americans in 1992. And 56% of the respondents to the survey reported that they had used a gun in self-defense during the past year. Now, that in and of itself is pretty bizarre. 56%, you just, randomly call 5,000 people and 56% of them say, yeah, I used a gun in self-defense in the last 12 months. I mean, I know a lot of people who own guns. I grew up in Michigan. We lived in Vermont. These are both states where guns are just everywhere. Family members of mine, one of my brothers is a gun enthusiast. My mom was very, very competent with firearms. She'd had a rifle since she was a little kid. I don't know a single person who's ever used a gun in self-defense. And I know a lot of people. I mean, maybe there's somebody who's just aching to tell me the story, but I've just never heard it. And it's not like this topic has never come up before. So anyhow, they called 5,000 people. 56% of them said, yep. Then they did the math. They said, okay, if 56% of 5,000 people did, then you multiply that by the number of people, 200 million people in the United States at that time, and therefore 2.5 million people a year. I'm sorry. It wasn't 56%. It was 56 respondents. No wonder. No wonder I was baffled. Okay, 56 respondents out of 5,000. That's about what? It's a little more than 1%, but that's still 1 out of 100. A little more than 1 out of 100. And then they multiplied that by the population, 200 million, and they said, okay, you got a little more than 2.5 million uses a year. Forgive me, I had my math was off there. But even that, 1% seems pretty absurd, particularly when you get this. These guys dug into the research that Gleck and Gertz did, and they talk about this thing called social desirability, which is basically where you give people the answers that you think they want. And so they said, you know, for example, in this discussion of the pitfalls of using the Gleck-Gertz survey to make population projections about the incidence of defensive gun use, David Hemingway of Harvard University cites a 1994 phone survey of 1,500 adults living in the United States. 6% of the respondents to that survey, now that's almost six times as many, 6% of the respondents to that survey reporting having had personal contact with aliens from another planet. That would be not 2.5 million. That would be, you know, out of 200 million people, that would be over 12 million. But here's the kicker. The 6% can be explained, these scholars write, by the series of questions that led up to the question about contact with aliens, which set up the person being interviewed, the respondent, to expect that the interviewer was hoping for some alien contact answer. In addition, some small yet non-negligible percentage of survey respondents could be expected to have mental conditions that impair their perceptions and lead them to report defensive gun incidents that actually did not happen. So the bottom line, they're saying, come on, these numbers are nonsense. Bob in Renton, Washington. Hey, Bob, you wanted to talk about the NFL and guns.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call. You know, you had a gentleman earlier that you were debating with about NFL football isn't the forum to talk about an NFL player that actually ended up killing himself with a gun.
And his girlfriend.
And yes, and his girlfriend. And, you know, the person that you debated suggested that people who watch NFL football are not educated enough, nor are they socially equipped to handle the topic of gun control. And I find that laughable because plenty of people who are doctors, lawyers, judges, teachers, police, military members, etc., and the list goes on. Watch NFL football.
Well, Alan's not here to defend himself, but I'm not going to try and get inside his head, but I do think that you're slightly misrepresenting or misconstruing what he said, because my understanding of what he said wasn't that people aren't competent or capable of dealing with it, but rather they don't expect to. That when you're watching football, what you expect to have is sports.
But you're talking about a situation where a gentleman that plays the game, that's a member of it.
Oh, I agree with you.
This crime.
I agree with you. I'm just
the most perfect.
You know, and I agree with you that doctors and lawyers and everybody else watches football. I mean, you know, it's
plenty of people do.
So yeah, it's you know, and even a few women. I mean, although overwhelmingly men watch football, but it's
no, there's a lot of women that watch football.
Yeah. Okay. So any other point?
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's ridiculous that we have this idea that, you know, this is a situation where we can't talk about this in this forum, and that forum actually fits exactly.
Yeah, I thought it was a very relevant and the perfect moment, because Bob Costas was talking to America, and it's not very often that you talk to America as opposed to talking political wonks. Presidential debate, you're talking to political wonks. Bob Costas, he's talking to Joe Sixpack. He's talking to America. And that, I agree with you, Bob. Thank you very much for the call. Tim in Utica, Michigan. Hey, Tim. Thanks for listening to XM. What's your take on you suggest, well, let me let you say it.
Well, what I find somewhat amusing is the fact that the people who are very adamant about no restriction at all about bearing arms are usually the ones that want to put restrictions on every other aspect of our lives.
In other words, they're the ones who advocate the pot bans. They're the ones who think that gays shouldn't get married. They're the ones that think women shouldn't have access to birth control, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, the so-called social conservatives.
Yes.
I think that there is actually a certain cleavage between the gun folks and those other folks, in that we only lump them all together because the Republican Party has has created a coalition of all these various niches, and so collectively they all call themselves Republicans. But I would guess that the average person who stands in front of an abortion clinic, you know, to shout at people going in, it probably isn't the same person who's going to be standing, you know, in front of a local courthouse yelling about gun rights or the Supreme Court or something like that. I think that there's a little more split. But I do get your point. They all identify themselves as Republicans, as right-wingers. And, yes, we want our gun rights, but other rights? No, not so much. Excellent point, Tim. Thank you. Gilbert in British Columbia, Canada, speaking of our neighbor to the north, you had some thoughts on the colonial perspective on gun laws?
Yeah, we just went through a whole pile of gun regulations. I know handguns in Canada, a lot of people don't realize you've had to register them since 1938, and there's quite a process that you go through to have them.
Mm-hmm.
The long guns, which they just got rid of the registry, that was all basically a political thing. Like, they go to the cities, like, basically there's three big cities that vote our federal parties in, so they all tell the public they're going to get rid of the guns, and of course that's going to get rid of the crime, when in fact all we need to do is enforce the laws that we have.
Right. Yeah, and I don't disagree. It's like there's these guys running around Detroit right now with the AK-47s, you know, sticking up gas stations and convenience stores, and that's a horrible thing. But, you know, let's follow the chain of causality here. The guys running around are able to get these guns. And for that matter, they don't have decent jobs in a factory. I mean, one of the things that we absolutely know is that when employment is high, crime is low. Okay? So when unemployment is high, crime goes up. So you've got massive unemployment in Detroit. And then on top of that, you have, and so what's causing that massive unemployment? In large part, our insane trade policies. So you could argue that and not only our insane trade policies, but what's causing our insane trade policies? The fact that you've got such a concentration of political power in the hands of a small number of corporations and the billionaires that make them, or vice versa, who are made billionaires by those corporations, who are interested in making money transnationally rather than just domestically. I'm reading Plutocrats by Krista Freeland, a brilliant book on this topic. That and all of that came out of the Reagan tax cuts for the very, very wealthy, and the Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act. All of this came, you know, out of the 80s. This didn't exist before the 80s. And we pretty much didn't have that big a problem with gun crime in the United States before the 80s. We certainly, I mean, you go back and watch some of the old police TV shows from before the 80s, you know, McMillan and Wife or Quincy or Magnum PI or whatever. And, you know, the police would show up and they'd have one handgun and it would be a fairly small one. You know, it wasn't the SWAT team with the AK-47s and all this other stuff. So yeah, I'm with you, Gilbert.
We don't have like a tremendous amount. Like, a lot of times you see everybody gets shot, all these people getting shot in the news. But a lot of those people that are getting shot, it comes back that, as they say on the news, the people were known to the police. I'm in agreement of, I have handguns, and they're registered, and we have to go through quite a bit of regulation to get them. I don't run around with a handgun.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the exact law is, but I know in Canada, like Britain, if you're caught with a gun in the commission of a crime.
Oh, in the United States too, the penalty is much worse.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Gilbert, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to us on Sirius Satellite Radio in British Columbia. We'll be back. This show is sponsored in part by the Tom Hartman Store, with T-shirts and mugs and bags. Oh, my! All that and more at TomHartman.com. Click store. Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Terry in Gainesville, Georgia. Boy, it's been a while since I've been in Gainesville, but it's a nice little town. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Yes, hey, how's it going?
Oh, it's Tony.
Today?
I'm sorry. Tony.
Tony. All right, to New York. Hey, find out why you, my question was, why are you wanting to impose more gun laws or stricter laws instead of enforcing the laws that we currently have?
Well, first of all,
if someone wants to do a malicious, go ahead.
Well, you have not heard me advocate any new laws. I do think that the assault weapons ban, which was endorsed by both President Bushes and by Bill Clinton, by both parties, I think that that is a reasonable thing to bring back, high-capacity clips. I mean, if somebody's going to have military weaponry, they should have a reason for military weaponry. But with regard to pistols and long rifles, I think that states, counties, and cities should have the right to make up their own rules on these with regard to regulation. In Vermont, where Louise and I lived for almost a decade, you could. I'm assuming it's still that way. It was when we lived there. It's been 8 or 10 years since we moved out of Vermont. But you could walk into a gun store, buy a gun, stick it in your pocket, in other words, have it as a concealed weapon, and carry it with you for the rest of your life, and nobody would say boo. They're basically, it's the most unrestrictive gun laws in the country. Bernie Sanders has a 100% rating with the NRA, because that's the way the people of Vermont want it. They have very little crime. There's a lot of people who hunt, and it's a very rural state with a low population. On the other hand, in Manhattan, they've had some real problems with gun violence, and so they put into place some very restrictive gun laws. I respect the right of local people by majority vote to elect representatives who will pass laws that reflect the will of those people. And if it doesn't reflect the will of those people, they can throw the bums out to decide whether or not they want people to have to register if they own a firearm, or at the very least have a license, to demonstrate proficiency to have a firearm. But I'm not saying that it should be an absolute national thing. I don't want to change Vermont's laws.
Right. And I agree with you on that part. The problem comes in, no one will ever stop a criminal from obtaining a weapon, whatever the weapon may be, a high-capacity clip, a fully auto AR, AK-47, M16, whatever you choose. The common term is AK-47.
But Tony, ask any police officer, and we've had a number of them on this show. During the time when the assault weapon ban was in place, there was less violence in the United States that was associated with high-capacity weapons than there was before and than there has been since. That guy who tried to kill Gabby Giffords and did succeed in killing, as I recall, 7 other people, had he had a pistol that only had a maximum of 9 rounds in it, I doubt he would have been able to do what he did. And that's the whole point of that. You know, the same thing with the Klebold and what's his name, you know, the Harrison Klebold, the Columbine killers. It's like, let's make it harder to get military weaponry. One of the other big problems is, you know, this whole Fast and Furious thing that George W. Bush started, where they were, you know, in Arizona, you can buy as many automatic or semi-automatic weapons as you want, as long as you state there for your own use. But as soon as you walk out of the store, literally, the second you walk out of the store, you can decide, oh, I'm not going to use it for my own use anymore. All you have to do is declare it to the store owner, and then you can sell it to a Mexican drug lord. And that was happening with hundreds of thousands of weapons being funneled out of Arizona and into Mexico. And an assault weapons ban would put an end to that trade, too, which I think would be a good thing.
Right. Correct that statement, though. It was not Fast and Furious is something under the President Obama administration.
The original program was started by George W. Bush. It was called something like Guns Walking, and
correct.
Then it got reinvented during the Obama administration
very, very
as Fast and Furious.
Program. It was highly restricted under George W. Bush, and they had a different parameter under Obama. That's a whole different topic, whole different day. We won't go there.
Okay.
But there's a lot of responsible gun owners. I mean, I have my hand on my gun right now. I mean, I carry it. It's on my person. In the car, I don't keep it on me. I keep it on my armrest. But there's a lot of responsible gun people out there.
I don't disagree, Tony. I just, you know I'm telling you, I don't disagree. I'm saying that...
I have a license. And the thing that really makes it, you know, that differentiates a responsible gun owner versus someone who just has a gun is, you know, when I travel to South Carolina, I know I have to pop the clip out of my gun and I have to keep it separated.
Right.
I know I can't carry my gun concealed on me in South Carolina.
Right.
Because they don't reciprocate the license of Georgia.
Yeah.
And right there, you know, is kind of a,
well, that's where gun rights versus states' rights.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't need to have a different driver's license to go to a different state.
Yeah.
But I need to have a different gun license. And, you know, that's kind of a boundary where
But the solution to that, Tony, is national gun licensure. And that is one of the things that the NRA hates more than anything.
hates more?
Well, you know, he opposes, shall we say.
Oh, opposes. Now, I think a national would be very good because, you know, once you have a license in your state, whether it be for a car or a gun, you don't have to worry traveling across state lines of, oh, geez, what state am I in? I can't remember. Is Alabama reciprocal or not? Oh, geez, what do I got to do here?
See, I would say for people who need guns for making their living, and you could include self-defense in this with things like truck drivers, long haul over the road truck drivers who get stuck up at you know, rest stops a lot. In other words, they find themselves in high crime areas more often than probably the average person does. I agree with you. And I would say that certainly for police officers or others who may travel and need to carry a weapon with them, they shouldn't have to worry about how the one gun law, the states of, you know, how one state's differences from another state causes things to blow up. But for the average person who has bought a gun for self-defense because they believe that they live in a dangerous place, I think that, again, you're infringing. If you're moving into another person's territory or another community, you're infringing on that community's right to determine how they want guns regulated in their community, in my opinion. So, but Tony, we'll have to leave it there as a polite disagreement. But thank you for pointing out the rationale and being one of the rational gun owners. The rationality of most gun owners in the United States. Most are good, decent people. We'll be back. It's 2 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. If at first you don't succeed, bribe again. You know, the top oligarch in the Republican Party right now is this guy, Shelley Adelson. I've heard Adelson and Adelson. I kind of like Adelson because it's like addled. But in any case, he's a, you could call him a foreign casino magnate. Because he owns foreign casinos. He's not a foreigner. He's an American. His parents were first-generation immigrants. And he's on his way to Washington, D.C. He's already offering to fund the next election for Republicans. Why? Apparently to protect himself from criminal prosecution. Adelson spent $150 million on Republicans in the 2012 election, probably, you know, I don't know, a day's worth of income or so, more than anyone in American election history. This guy's a multi-billionaire. And now he's promising to spend double that amount come the next election and has already met with Governor John Kasich, Governor Bobby Jindal, Governor Bob McDonnell, all these 26 possible Republicans to get him on his side. Interestingly, Jeb Bush and Chris Christie are not on that list. They're more sane voices in the Republican Party. And I realize I have to highly qualify that by saying sane, but in any case. All this is pretty odd when you consider that this same Sheldon Adelson told the Wall Street Journal for publication yesterday that he supports abortion rights. He supports stem cell research. He supports President Obama's DREAM Act. And in his own words, he's, quote, in favor of socialized medicine, end quote. So why is this guy who used to be a Democrat and holds the values of the Democratic Party, at least in terms of social policy, why is this guy so busy buying Republicans? Some people think it has to do with Israel. I don't think it has anything to do with Israel. There's not that much space between Democrats and Republicans on the topic of Israel. Here's my take on this. Put yourself in his place. Democrats generally do things, that is, you know, make laws, legislate, on behalf of the vast majority of the American people. Unemployment insurance, Social Security, Medicare, keeping our food supply safe, that sort of thing. I mean, outside of petty crime stuff like Congressman Jefferson or Rangel were accused of, by and large, Democrats don't shill for big corporate interests or fat cat billionaires. They, you know, if they get busted, it's for texting a picture of their underwear. They've been the party of the people pretty much since their founding over 200 years ago. But Republicans eagerly do things for whoever pays them the biggest bucks. For example, every single Republican freshman in the last Congress denies that there's any such thing as global warming. Now, this is clearly a crazy position. But why would they take that? Because the fossil fuel industry, the second richest industry in the world, behind the banksters, will give a lot of money to any member of Congress who denies global climate change. And similarly, the Republicans are lockstep against banking regulations. Why? Because that industry passes out the largest amount of cash here in Washington, D.C., and Republicans are in favor, you know, you got that. Okay, that, what are some of the other things that they favor? Republicans are in favor of so-called free trade and so-called right to work. Both policies that harm the vast majority of working class Americans, but make fortunes for the transnational corporations and their billionaire CEOs who eagerly pass out bucks to any politician willing to take their side. Republicans will even deny science, like the age of the earth, if they think it'll help them raise money from cash-heavy televangelists and scam artists like Ralph Reed. In other words, by and large, the Democrats can't be bought. But the Republicans are perpetually for sale to the highest bidder. So if you're looking to buy a law, who do you go to? While Shelley Adelson may think that stem cell research or immigrant rights or literally socialized medicine, even Democrats don't go that far. While he may think these are fine, and in fact, he cites the example of having spent time in Israel and just being blown away by their great socialized medicine system. While he may like all those things, he wrote about it yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. His first priority is not, you know, policies like that. His first priority is covering his own butt. So if at first you don't succeed, bribe again. The Washington Post reports that Adelson is flying in his private jet to Washington, D.C. to meet with Republican leaders in, surprise, hopes of changing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Now, why would he care about this? Because right as we speak, President Obama's Department of Justice is investigating Adelson for violating that act, as it's been suggested that he was bribing officials in China to get his casinos built on Chinese-controlled territory. Which, of course, is probably why Adelson spent so much money to defeat President Obama, because a Republican Romney administration would bring with it a new Republican Attorney General and Justice Department that just might not prosecute him or might just settle out of court for a small fine to make it all go away. This is the life of the rich and powerful in America. When they get in trouble with the law, they just buy new politicians and get new laws to protect themselves. We used to have a word for this. It's called bribery. Remember that? But now, thanks to the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, it's just business as usual. If that outrages you, if you think that there's something fundamentally wrong with that, I strongly recommend you get over to movetoamend.org and say something about it. Now, meanwhile, as we speak, Donna in Lincoln Park, Michigan, has a news report for us, as it were. Donna, thank you for calling. Protesters in Michigan who are protesting the right to work for less law that's been debated in the Michigan Senate. Tell me about this.
Yeah, I just wanted to update you and bring some attention to the forefront. It's not getting a lot of media attention. Even more people protesting on the Capitol today in Lansing. Governor Snyder, who is a Republican, of course, has agreed to fast-track this, get it through in a lame-duck session, the right-to-work law. He's really pushing it, of course.
And we should explain, right-to-work means right-to-work for less. It means that the state will no longer defend union rights.
Exactly. And reduce our standard of living and, you know, the whole sequela from that. But they have pepper-sprayed some protesters. And arrested, I think, 8 or 10 people. So it is getting pretty heated at the Capitol, and just want to bring it to the forefront of people's attention to try to support Michigan right now. We're stymied. I think this is going to pass. Unfortunately, we have a Republican Senate and Congress, you know, Senate and House in the state, as well as the gubernatorial, leader. And, it's just shocking in one of the most union-based states in the nation. I mean, a real where Walter Reuther, you know, led the mission years ago, that this is getting ramrodded through on a moment's notice, literally. I just can't believe that this is happening to our state. It's just, it's stunning. It just is incredible given our history for labor rights and
Mitch Daniels in Indiana pulled it off a year or so ago in Indiana. Mitch Daniels, wasn't he the governor of Indiana when he pulled that off a year or two ago in Indiana? Or isn't he the governor?
I believe so. And Snyder is using Indiana as the prop for Michigan going forward because he's proposing that they're getting more businesses to move into the state of Indiana and setting up shop and that would be so good for Michigan and blah, blah, blah.
Let's have a race to the bottom.
It's going to be great.
Yeah, let's become like Mississippi and Indiana.
Yeah, Michigan, the new Mississippi. Yep.
Yeah. The new slogan. Yeah. Now, look nice on the license plates. It used to be when I was a little kid, Michigan's license plate said Winter Water Wonderland. What do they say now?
I think it's the Great Lakes State.
Great Lakes State. Yeah, well, pretty soon they could say Michigan, the new Mississippi.
Exactly.
Amazing.
It's just
okay, so if you're in Michigan, get to Lansing. And, you know, if you're not, you may want to call the Michigan Congressional delegation, tell them that you're concerned about these issues. They should be speaking out, Michigan's two senators, Stabenow and Levin, and there's, I don't know how many members of the House of Representatives in Michigan, but there's certainly a bunch of them in the neighborhood of probably 10. Donna, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Get thee to Lansing. This is, you know, this is another one of those really big deals that doesn't get any coverage in the corporate media that doesn't like unions. Sheldon Adelson. Sheldon Adelson. We have geniuses working on this program, I tell you. Thank you, Shano. The Republican Party's descent into complete madness reached a new depth this week. Seriously, this is not a joke. Whipped up by paranoid delusions of a one-world autocratic government, Senate Republicans yesterday killed an international treaty designed to help people with disabilities all across the planet. This is the UN-sponsored Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And it simply requires signatory nations to provide for their disabled populations the same way the 1990s Americans with Disability Act provides for American disabled populations. It would have required absolutely no changes to existing EU law since, again, we already passed the Americans with Disabilities Act more than 20 years ago. Ratification of that treaty simply meant that the United States, like 126 other nations that have already approved the treaty, is saying, yes, we're on board with setting standards for the rest of the world to follow that are the same standards we already have when it comes to meeting the needs of the disabled. We Americans used to pride ourselves in setting moral examples for the rest of the world, which is why former President George W. Bush first signed the treaty in 2006 and why it was re-signed by President Obama in 2009. It just needed to get through the Senate. So former Republican senator and presidential candidate Robert Dole, himself a disabled veteran of World War II and now in a wheelchair, championed the treaty. He was wheeled onto the Senate floor for the vote, where he watched Senator John Kerry plead with his colleagues to not let Senator Bob Dole down. Remember, Dole is a Republican. The treaty had bipartisan support. John McCain, Dick Lugar, John Barrasso, they were in favor of it. They're all Republicans. They got 61 votes in the Senate. But treaties require a two-thirds majority to be ratified. It's in the Constitution, so they were 5 votes short of passing. 38 Republican senators walked right past Bob Dole and his wheelchair, the former Republican candidate for president, walked right by him to cast a no vote. Why? Because they want to continue to pander to a paranoid minority of the Republican base that thinks the UN is secretly assembling a global government to destroy American sovereignty, throw mothers in the Hague, and condemn their disabled children to death. For example, days before the vote, Rick Santorum penned an op-ed for the conservative birther website WorldNet Daily titled, "This Treaty Crushes U.S. Sovereignty," in which he attacked a specific provision in the treaty, Section 7, that reads, quote, in all actions concerning children with disabilities, the best interests of the child shall be a primary consideration, end quote. That's all it says. But this was really nefarious. To the ever-paranoid Santorum, who wrote in this World in a Daily Please, he says, in the case of our four-year-old daughter Bella, who has trisomy 18, a condition that the medical literature says is incompatible with life, would her best interest be that she be allowed to die? Some would undoubtedly say so. End of quote. I don't think so, Rick. I mean, this is just like Sarah Palin's hysterical death panels during the Obamacare debate. Santorum is pushing for a no vote on the treaty because he's either genuinely believed that the UN's one world government wants to demand the sacrifice of his four-year-old daughter, or, in my opinion, far more likely, I don't think Rick Santorum's an idiot. You don't get where he is by being an idiot. I think he cynically wanted to scare the hell out of his base to help his fundraising. Utah Senator Mike Lee, another one of these right-wing crazies, echoed Rick Santorum. In fact, he led the opposition to the treaty on the floor of the Senate, calling this a march towards socialism. Now, he probably opposes the American with Disabilities Act, too. What? You're building a building and you have to put an elevator in it? Oh, we can't have that. Might cost a little extra money for the developer. Other opposing senators raised concerns that the treaty would prohibit disabled children from being homeschooled if homes aren't equipped with ramps and retrofitted to accommodate the disabled. This is silly. It's a nonsense argument. But to accommodate the paranoids, the Senate committee that approved the treaty even included specific language that would bar its use in civil court lawsuits. Again, not one single U.S. law would have changed if this treaty was ratified by the Senate. In fact, it had the potential to be very beneficial to disabled Americans who are traveling abroad, people like former Senator Dole, by giving them the same accommodations that they get in the United States when they're in a foreign country. But ultimately, fear won. Motivated by this paranoia that this all-powerful United Nations, which actually has very little power in it, is going to send their international police forces not to go after tyrants and despots guilty of war crimes, which, by the way, they don't even do that very well, right? Bashir is still running Sudan, North Sudan, even though he's been indicted as a war criminal. There's a warrant out for him. The UN's not going to send somebody in to take him out. But in Santorum's mind, you know, the UN wants to send their police after his four-year-old daughter or a homeschool teacher who hasn't installed a ramp on their front door. And so he killed the treaty. This should be an extraordinary teaching moment. In the face of this insanity, we Americans should ask ourselves, what happens when one of the two major political parties in the United States either completely loses its grip on reality or chooses to pander to a base that's gone nuts? I mean, this is the same Republican Party that's currently hyping up another UN One World conspiracy known as Agenda 21. Despite it simply calling on nations to promote more sustainable development practices, Republicans think it's a plot to push America, take Americans out of rural areas and shove them into the cities and outlaw golf courses. Right? There's no reality to that. But the Republicans are terrified of it anyway. And it's not anything new. I mean, you know, we used to be scared. Oh, but duck and cover, the Soviets are coming to get you. Al-Qaeda is going to take over the world. You know, reality has never played a real important role in Republican fear-mongering. It's really time for the rational Republicans to step up and say, okay, here we are, we're rational Republicans, we're taking over, guys, not for the crazies, please. I'm speaking to the adults in the Republican Party who may be listening or watching, please.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Please take back your party. Go read the 1956 Republican Party platform. It was once a sane party. Paranoia, 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man. Is there a right time to talk about guns in America? We've covered that. Shane was just telling me that he got an email from Rick Santorum talking about how he saved America from the UN again. By the way, please send money. This guy's fundraising on these things. All these guys are fundraising on this stuff. It's totally cynical. It's tragically, totally cynical. In fact, Shana, you should forward me that email. I'll forward it to Sam, and maybe we can pop it up on the screen tonight. So, did you hear that the Senator Max Baucus's chief lawyer, Liz Fowler, or excuse me, Health Policy Counsel? This is the person who apparently was one of the main authors of Obamacare. She has now taken a job as a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry. You know, following in the footsteps of Billy Towson, although he was actually a member of Congress. This is the revolving door in D.C. I mean, this is how this city works. And there's something just fundamentally wrong with that. That the way this city works is that everybody is in it for something, and that the Supreme Court made it possible. We used to have laws against revolving doors. We used to have laws against, you know, giving, you know, Shelley Adelson trying to buy politicians. You know, he's coming to town and he's saying, yeah, I spent $150 million last year. I'm going to spend $300 million, you know, year after next. It's not his way of bragging that he wants to be a Republican kingmaker. It's his way of saying, who's going to line up to do what he wants? Of asking, you know, who's going to line up to do what he wants? It's incredible. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't think the Republicans will ever disassociate themselves from stupid or crazy?
No, they won't. They haven't
not?
Learned their lesson because Rick Santorum and people like him are going to drag sensible people that's in the middle, far to the right, just to get the nomination. Huntsman scared the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. I was happy that he wasn't the candidate to run.
And Huntsman could have won.
Beg your pardon?
Huntsman could have won.
As a matter of fact, if I'm President Obama, I would slap them right in the face, and my Secretary of State would be John Huntsman.
Hmm.
He knows China. He's been the ambassador. He speaks Mandarin.
That's interesting.
So this is a guy that understands what's going on. He would be my nominee. These people, they have no shame. Rick Santorum is basically using his daughter, and I feel comfortable saying this, as a way
to raise
money.
Yeah.
Run for
yeah.
election.
Yeah, he may not even run for election. He's raising money for his PAC, and he can use that
yeah.
money from a PAC. There's very loose rules about how you can use PAC money. As Stephen Colbert
yeah.
pointed out, when his, you know, when the elections were over, there was hundreds of thousands of dollars left in Stephen Colbert's PAC. He brought his lawyer on the air who said, here, if you just sign this document, you can take all the money.
Right. They won't learn their lesson. They will nominate another guy that will go far to the right, or they would drive a sensible candidate so far to the right that they have to go there. They don't realize that the demographics of the country has changed right before their eyes. Reaganomics has been proven to be a 30-year failure to our country, and they're just keep moseying along like nothing has happened.
Yeah.
There's nothing to see here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. No droids in this car. Just nothing but Republican crazy. Carl, excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Greg in Livonia, Michigan, listening on WDTW. You wanted to talk about the Michigan protests?
Yes, I did, Tom. I only just now returned from that protest in Lansing. Unfortunately, there have been a number of negative developments in that struggle. There are several people that attempted to rush the Senate floor in the Michigan Capitol building, and they were maced by police, and they were arrested and led away into jail. Secondarily, as I was driving home along I-96, we saw several Michigan State Police trooper cars, a dozen of them, racing toward the Capitol in the opposite direction at very high speed. Apparently, I regret to report there were shots fired at this protest. I do not know who did it. I don't know offhand if there were any.
How do you know? You just heard it? I mean, it could have been firecrackers.
No, actually, I did not hear it myself. But my companion in the back seat said that there was a report of this in the press over
a
cell phone.
Let's be careful of let's be careful about asserting something that serious.
We'll
take that as the story of a story of somebody who said that they heard the story, okay?
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I agree until it's confirmed in the press, actually. Yeah. Right. And a third point that I wanted to make on that is that the lobbyists for the right to work legislation were so in your face about it. I mean, they came out of the buildings, the Capitol buildings. They lit up celebratory cigars and they blew smoke in our faces and they were smirking and smiling and getting in everyone's every union member's face about their victory that they've claimed since they murdered the middle class here in Michigan. And it was just unconscionable that these persons would do this kind of thing. It's just silly.
That's incredible. It's like the people throwing paper down on the Occupy protesters in D.C. while they were having their champagne party. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WDTW. Deborah in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Deborah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to your show today. So I'm going to bring back up the gun control issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also reading William Hoagland's book, Founding Finance, based on your show of last week, finding that fascinating. I've also learned from William Hoagland's book that militias at that time were primarily based of working class folks, infantry from the Revolutionary War that were released and went back to their states and formed militias, and were fighting the elite, literally like the folks in Michigan are apparently doing, or something's going on in Michigan today.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is there a way to look at the Second Amendment now in light of William Hoagland's book? The most difficult words in the Constitution to interpret apparently are a well-regulated militia. Is it possible to, given that we can go back and understand that the elites that were writing our Constitution were against working class people and the working class people were forming these militias, that the Second Amendment did indeed refer not to individuals, but to militias?
Yeah. Yes. I think you just brought it up. I would commend to you actually a book that I wrote called What Would Jefferson Do that it pulls together a lot of other research from those early years, from the particularly the writing of the Constitution, and suggests that many of the people who wrote the Constitution were not the elites. They were literally teachers and singers and artists and writers. And there were some elites, but the really, truly rich elites, Krista Freeland points this out. I'm reading Krista Freeland's book, Plutocrats, right now, and she points this out, too. We had even the richest person in America at the time of the Revolution was a piker compared to the poor of the rich in the United Kingdom. To call them the elites is... it's a literal truth, but there has to be a larger context to understand it. And they're nothing like the elites of today. They were nothing like the elites of the late 19th century of the Gilded Age, and with multi-millionaires. The richest among the founders, among the signers of the Declaration of Independence, was John Hancock, and he was worth in today's money $700,000. That was his net worth. That was a big deal back then. But the as Krista Freeland points out in her book Plutocrats, the difference between the very poor in the United States and the very rich in the United States was very, very small. That time, that founding era, even when you include slaves, was among the most egalitarian this country's ever been. And back to the well-regulated militia. Yeah, I think that there needs to be a discussion of the well-regulated militia. The Supreme Court has by and large set that aside. And I do think we need to have that conversation. Deborah, got to move along. Thank you for the call. Paul in Mukilteo, Washington. Hey, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just listening to everybody talking about the right-wingers complaining about when the gun control discussion should take place. And I think that their biggest problem was really where that discussion took place. Your average NFL fan, I know there are exceptions, but most of them are just a little to the right of the Tea Party. And they were right in the middle of their weekly 3-hour hate, and violence.
I don't think so. I think the average NFL fan is a little to the right of the Republican Party, but not to the, you know, not anywhere near as far gone as the Tea Party.
Well, the one, okay, and being to the right of the Republican Party, in my opinion, is completely insane at this point. But still, I think the point is valid. It was the wrong place to talk about it because you forced them to confront it.
Yeah, but that was the whole point of what Casas was trying to do, and the guy that he was quoting, who's got his name here someplace, Perkins. No, Perkins was the girlfriend. Kansas City-based Jason Whitlock. Jason Whitlock was the original author that Bob Costas. Most of what Bob Costas said, he was quoting Jason Whitlock. And I think it was a pretty solid piece. But I get your point, Paul, that people are offended. But, hey, I don't want my football. I don't want to talk about gun control or guns. It wasn't even gun control. It was just, you know, we should have a conversation about guns.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think it's a fine time to have a conversation about guns in America. I'm surprised, frankly, when Gabby Giffords was shot that we didn't have a gun conversation in this country.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Yeah, let's check in on the news. Our news from the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. This Christmas, you can give a crystal heart. They're made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. And if you'd like to do that, they're great, great Christmas gifts or holiday gifts. Go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com. That's goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, live from New York City. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world today?
Well, oh my gosh, there's a lot going on in Washington. And of course, New York City is all upset at the UN because of what's going on in Syria. Mm. And now two other people from Morsi's regime have resigned in Egypt. So you got Syria going on, you got Egypt going on.
Is it pretty credible reporting that Syria is actually loading nerve gas into their weapons?
Yes. Now, the issue is that they haven't loaded it into their planes, but the sarin gas is only useful for 60 days. So what we don't know as mere presslings is whether that sarin gas, whether he's using all of his stockpile, whether he uses just some of his stockpile, does he have more left, and so he's just taking a chance, or is he saying, hey, this is all I got, and I'm going to use it.
Is it possible that Al-Assad is going to pull a Jivan here? He's gonna kill everybody and then kill himself, basically.
Well, you know something interesting. I mean, first of all, as you know, he's a physician, and so he took the Hippocratic oath. But his father papered over a town, basically, just sent in tanks and killed, I don't know, 25,000-30,000 people.
Wow.
In one night. So. On one hand, he may be a physician. On the other hand, he may be his father's son.
Yeah. I thought he was an optometrist, which is not quite
an ophthalmologist.
Ophthalmologist. MD. Oh, so he's an MD. Wow.
Yes.
Amazing.
Quite astounding,
yep,
when you think about it.
Yeah,
okay.
It
Nancy Pelosi is after Congress because she says that they have decided to adjourn. She really slammed them for that today.
This is the House of Representatives.
What?
The House of Representatives, John Boehner.
House of Representatives, yes. By the way, John Boehner and the president have been having a conversation with each other, and it did not leak out. So what we're hearing, Tom, is there may be a short-term solution. They may say, okay, we're going to extend everything, you know, for 3 months or whatever, and then let the new Congress deal with it.
They're going to extend it until the debt ceiling stuff comes up. That's what Boehner has in mind, I would bet.
Right.
I mean, I have no inside information.
He's not going to yield on the debt ceiling.
Yeah, whereas the president yesterday said he's not going to play that game. And I don't know how he can avoid it.
I don't either, but we'll see. Bernie Sanders and Maria Cantwell today had a presser, and they talked about getting the FCC to avoid softening rules on cross-ownership in the media market. That means you can't own newspapers if you're the only game in town with radio, et cetera, or TV. And basically, Bernie said that 30 years ago, 50 different companies owned 90% of American media, and now that number is only number 6. General Electric, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS.
Wow, that's incredible. And this is Julius Genachowski, the chairman of the FCC, appointed by a Democrat, appointed by Obama, I believe. who is talking about allowing Rupert Murdoch to basically buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Sun, even though he owns television stations in those cities, and end up with, you know, functional media monopolies in some of the largest markets in America, much as he has or is close to having in New York City. And, you know, we should look at Italy and see what...
Well, you know, what's interesting on this is, of course, a lot of people are playing this potential newspaper purchase as possibilities by saying, well, they had to do this because of the scandal on the wiretapping that happened in England. But it really may be this FCC rule, and the press is overlooking that.
They had to do... Who has to do what? What?
In other words, they split up News Corp into two corporations.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That just was announced like 2 days ago, I think. So,
are they both 7% owned by the Saudi prince? What's his name?
I haven't seen the ownership divide, but I do know that they're splitting News Corp up into two corporations. And a lot of people believe that this was a way to get England off their back because of the scandal that took place in tapping people's phones.
Sure.
But it may be more this FCC issue.
Right. They have one corporation on the newspapers and another corporation on the TV stations.
Right. And they're what they would call their entertainment properties.
Right. Remarkable.
And because there's Fox Searchlight as well.
Right. And the studios and the
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Huh. Exactly. So I think that's how they're going to try and sort of maneuver around that.
Makes perfect sense.
Meanwhile, of course, Jim DeMint is going to be resigning, and he is the senator from South Carolina. He's going to be taking over where we are next door at the Heritage Foundation. That means that there is going to be a two-year appointment. Probably it has to be a Republican to his seat. Then there will actually be two seats open in South Carolina at one time.
In 2014. Oh, because one of them is the scheduled. Well, that's going to be very interesting. Especially as that state gets gradually bluer and bluer.
Yes, and they say, well, both those states will probably go Republican, but I don't think so.
I don't think
so at all, particularly if it gets to be a nasty race about who's more conservative and all that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, in the primaries, yes.
It's Democrats can come right in on that.
Yep.
A couple other interesting things. There is an expansion of tar sands pipelines. And they are looking at that kind of thing. The National Wildlife Federation and others have warned that this could really ruin the environment, human health, landowner rights, etc. So this has to do with two companies that are looking to carry Canadian crude oil down to the United States and other places, like to the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is more than just TransCanada.
Yes, it is, apparently. It is more than TransCanada.
So everybody wants to carry toxic waste across the United States.
Everybody wants to get in on that.
It's the hot new thing to do. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And this brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. You can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of the goat and the person you helped. We'll be back with Michael Cushman, South Carolinian Southern Nationalist. Yes, you heard that right.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Michael Cushman is on the line with us. He is a South Carolinian and Southern Nationalist. Yes, you heard that right, Southern Nationalist. In fact, the website is southernnationalist.com. Michael, welcome to the program.
It's good to talk with you, Tom.
What is a Southern Nationalist?
Well, a Southern Nationalist is like a nationalist of any other people on this planet. So we want the best for our people, and we just want to see our people survive. We want the well-being of our people and ultimately the independence.
Who is, first of all, who are your people? Do you mean all the residents of the South? Do you mean all the residents of a particular state? Do you mean some of the, who are your people?
Well, I'm a South Carolinian, and my family has lived in South Carolina since the early 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
That's common among the native people here of the South, the people who built the civilization here. But it, more broadly, we're just talking about the Southern people in general.
Right. So are you talking about Southern white people?
I am white, and I'm not. I'm certainly not ashamed of that. I definitely want the best for my race as well. But this is—I really see it as something that would ultimately benefit all of the people of the South.
So, if South Carolina were to secede from the Union, or if all of the old Confederate states were to secede and become a separate nation, what would you do with the black people, the Asians, the Hispanics, the people of mixed race? I mean, these are people who, when your ancestors first settled that territory, were slaves or outcasts. What would you do with them?
Well, Tom, I'm not a politician. I don't seek to do anything with anyone. This is not about oppressing anyone. It's not about taking anyone's rights away.
Well, are they welcome to stay in the South?
I'm sorry?
Are they welcome to stay in the South?
Sure. I mean, the southern states have all passed stricter immigration laws, and those laws, if we were free from the federal government, you know, federal judges would not be able to just throw out those laws arbitrarily the way they have done over the last several years. But apart from that, the states would be able to establish, you know, their own immigration laws and so forth.
What so you're not among the white nationalists, for example, who are saying, you know, we want to create a state that's all white?
No, I'm not a white nationalist. I'm a Southern nationalist.
Okay. So if the South were to secede from the North or from the rest of the United States and reform the Confederate States of America, how, you know, the difference was fairly clear in 1860. The South was agricultural. The North was industrial. The South was slave. The North was also slave to a large extent, but it was a different kind of slavery. It was bonded indenture, factory work. But slavery was much more well-defined, shall we say, and well-developed in the South. Those differences seem to have largely gone away. I lived in Atlanta for 15 years, two of my three kids went to college in the South. And it doesn't seem to me like there's that much difference between, you know, Atlanta and Albany other than an accent. What is uniquely Southern that would differentiate the South from the North?
Well, Atlanta is much like Austin or Asheville or some of these other places. It's not very Southern at all now because most of the people who live there, or at least a very large percentage of them, are not Southerners. And so these areas, like much of the other parts of the South, the U.S. federal government has flooded these areas with immigrants from the Third World and just non-Southerners in general.
Immigrants from the Third World, people who are... I'm a white guy. I was flooded in there.
Well, also transplants as well, northern transplants.
So what are you going to do about that?
Well, if the Spanish government flooded Catalonia, for example, which is now trying to secede from Spain.
Well, they're not trying to secede. They just voted in a bunch of politicians who talk about secession. But I get your point.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, if they flooded Catalonia with non-Catalans and then said, well, what's the difference now between Catalonia and the rest of Spain? I mean, I'm sure that the Catalans who are native there and who want their independence, they would not look too kindly upon that. And we view it the same way.
But those were historically, Catalonia and Spain for hundreds of years were separate countries. Louise and I were in both the Basque region of Spain and in the Catalonian region in Barcelona just a couple of years ago. They speak a different language in Barcelona than they do in Madrid. They speak Catalonian.
Yeah, I lived there for 4 years. I'm aware of the situation there. But, you know, the same thing is true here. The South was founded as a separate civilization from the North. You know, we were part.
It was not.
Yes, we were. We were part of a broad civilization, plantation societies that stretched from Brazil all the way to Delaware. And that there's been a lot of authors who've written about that civilization. The U.S. educational system, of course, doesn't focus on it because it presents it the U.S. as a single nation. But that's
so how would it be different? What laws would you have in the South that we wouldn't have in the North? Or maybe I'm in the South. I'm in Washington, D.C., which is kind of right on the edge. But what laws would you have in the South that the North wouldn't have? Or what laws of the North would you reject in the South?
Well, lots of laws. You know, we could begin by getting rid of the anti-Southern, anti-white policies of the federal government, such as affirmative action. We could end third world immigration completely. We could get rid of the amnesties. We could restore local control of education. We could restore property rights and free association.
So it sounds like many of these things are, I mean, property rights and free association, that's code for, I can say, we don't want no black people in this place.
Well, it's a matter of self-ownership. I mean, you know, the libertarians would agree with me on this. I think anyone who believes that a person actually owns himself would agree with the right of private property and free association.
So you're agreeing with, I believe, you know, Rand Paul kind of stepped into this territory and then stepped back out very quickly some time back, that the laws that say that a business cannot discriminate against somebody on the basis of race should be done away with. You'd go back to legal apartheid.
No, I'm not.
How does that help the South?
I'm not favoring apartheid at all. That's not at all what I said. I said a free association and property rights is completely different.
No, well, I understand. But let's say that, you know, the majority of the Southern property owners decide that they're going to go back to, you know, white entrances and black entrances. How does that to their businesses, or, you know, whites only signs out in front of their businesses, how does that help the South?
Well, when we have freedom, we tend to be more prosperous. When we have freedom, people.
So you think that would bring
happy.
Prosperity?
I'm sorry?
You think that would bring prosperity, excluding people?
I think freedom brings prosperity, absolutely.
And you define that as freedom?
Well, self-ownership, private property, free association, absolutely. That's just freedom. A free individual has that right.
What about the African-Americans who would live in the South who want their freedom?
They would have that right also. They would have that right as well. I mean, they would also own themselves. I mean, I'm not talking about oppressing anybody. I'm talking about expanding freedom.
But you're saying that businesses should be able to say, based on the color of your skin, no, you can't come in here. By the way, you have the right, you have the freedom to start your own business where you can keep me out. Is that what you're saying, essentially?
Well, businesses should have the, you know, I as a business owner, if I own a business, I should be able to allow who I want in my business. Now, it's, of course, not in my economic interest to start denying groups of people entry. I mean, I lose business. So, I mean, the economic argument would be against me. But, I mean, you know, this is actually a minor part of the whole.
Well, I asked you what the difference would be between the North and the South, yeah. And it seemed like most of the things that you listed go back to race, you know, affirmative action,
well,
property, you know.
Some of those first things could possibly relate to race, but, you know, of course, you took the racial angle rather than the pro-liberty angle. But there's also the matter of, you know, a lot of us are tired of supporting the 1,000 U.S. federal military bases around the planet.
Well,
we
you know,
like
I'm with you on that.
Yeah,
I'm with you on that.
Lower taxes and all sorts of other things.
Okay. Michael Cushman, I just find this whole worldview fascinating. Michael Cushman, South Carolinian, Southern Nationalist, southernnationalist.com is the website. Thank you for being with us, Michael.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And thank you for your candor. I appreciate it. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you and Carl in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Carl, your thoughts on secession in the South?
Oh, I was just curious. You're carrying on about states' rights. And firstly, do we get all our federal property back? And secondly, how long is it going to take them to institute slavery again?
I don't know. I haven't heard conversation of slavery on, you know, you read some of these websites, but you do read certainly a lot about apartheid, you know, bringing back segregation. And
yeah, it's not that long of a step between the two.
Yeah, well.
Once you have second-class citizens, then they become cattle.
Right, and they may not be, well, they may not be chattel slaves. They may merely be wage slaves, but the function. You know, actually, wage slaves are more profitable for businesses than chattel slaves because you don't have to provide you know, living for them. You don't have to provide food for them. You just, you know, give them.
Yeah, they got to buy that out of. Yeah, they got to buy their own substance.
Right,
out.
Right. So the wage slavery of Walmart, you know, is much more profitable than the old fashioned chattel slavery of the South. So I don't think that's. But you know, it's interesting. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's
up?
Yeah,
hi. You had a guy say, are the Republicans going to stay irrational and crazy and stupid?
Yeah.
And the fact is, they have to be.
I agree.
Because
I don't think they've got anything else.
No, but it's more than that. If you're basically what the Republicans are telling everybody is, please pick your own pocket and give us your wallet.
Unless you're in the top 1%, in which case we'll take all those wallets.
Give your wallet to the rich, please. Right. Now, that's very irrational for anybody to do.
Yeah.
So for them to keep that up, they have to be irrational. They have to have an irrational message. They can't allow people to be scientific or logical, or they will figure out, for example, as your politician from the South that says he's not a politician, that we want freedom for corporations to do what they want, and they don't want it to occur to you that freedom actually has to do with people, with individuals. And you, when you're talking about freedom, it's my freedom to go into that store or not.
Right, right.
You know,
I got that, and that was the point that I was, you know, I'm trying to understand this, I think some of these people. I don't know. I don't want to speculate on people's motives. Lawrence, thank you for the call. Rose Marie in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. You are Catalonian?
Oh, yes, I am Catalonian, and I have a bone to pick with you, Tom.
Okay.
Yesterday, and today you repeat it again, talking about secession, like in the South, in the U.S. Well, nothing to do with the South in the U.S., but in Catalonia, we won our independence. You have no idea how much.
You did.
And the last.
I thought Catalonia was still part of Spain. I thought you just elected politicians who were pro-Catalonian secession.
Oh, no. Because we have elected, there are more than two parties. There is no parallelism with the U.S. We have elected only parties that want to be independent.
Right. Who want to be, but.
In the making.
But
oh, yes.
But Barcelona is not separate from Madrid. I mean, it's they're.
Oh no, we are under the boot of Spain.
Right. So you have not separated successfully.
No, but we want to.
Yes. Okay. Well, where am I wrong? Because that's what I thought I was saying too.
Well, I understood that you were saying that we don't want to secede.
Oh, no. It's very clear to me that the Catalonians want to secede. And so do the Basques,
yes.
Many of the Basques.
And regardless if we are part of the European community or not.
Right.
We want independence.
Yeah, I understand that, Rosemary. And in fact, I think that, you know, any country in Europe that has joined the European Union is nuts. And if the Catalonians are looking at this going, this is crazy, we should become our own country and secede, not just from Spain, but from the European Union. That makes sense to me, actually. But that's a different thing than saying that, you know, when Catalonia secedes, when Catalonia separates itself from Spain, that the Catalonians are then going to start putting signs on the door that say, if you're not a native Catalonian, you know, if you're from the Basque region or if you're from Madrid, you can't come in our business.
No, we are democratic. No.
Of course.
That will not happen. But we have been under ethnocide, linguistic and cultural for, you know, a long, long time.
I understand.
Something that usually people don't know.
It's happening.
I am 72 years old and I cannot wait. I want to, before I die, that I can say, finally, we are independent.
I understand. And I support your right to do that. And because historically Catalonia was a separate country. I'm not sure I buy the argument that historically the southern states of the United States were part of a separate country or part of a separate dynasty that went all the way to Brazil. You know, it sounds nice, but it doesn't comport with my reading of the debates at the Constitutional Convention, for example. So I think that there's a, you know, a real apples and oranges problem here. The Catalonians and secession or Castilian. Now, the Castilians, that's Madrid, right?
Yeah, well, Spain is the Spanish culture. There is no Spain. That's a fake. It's Castilian. The Castilians have been the warriors, and they have taken over.
Right. So the Castilians, who you know, which is you know basically Madrid was their capital. They took over the Basque region of Spain on one side and the Catalonian region on the other side and formed it into the modern Spain.
And also the Galician, Portugal, once also was part of the same.
Yes.
You know, under Castilian too.
Right, and Portugal so, successfully seceded.
Right.
I don't know when that was. But yeah, we all need to learn more European history.
Ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was in the last century, was it not? It was maybe right after World War I? I'm not sure. No.
It was prior.
It was prior to that. Okay. Rosemary, yeah. Thank you for the information, and thank you for calling and sharing it with us. I appreciate it. Very much appreciate it. And for listening or watching the program in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
John Kenneth Galbraith said, "The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises of moral philosophy, that is the search for the superior moral justification for selfishness." Bad and the very, very potomaniacally ugly, the good. Florida Democratic state legislators, take that, Rick Scott. Two Democratic state senators in the Sunshine State have introduced two bills that would reinstitute the 14 days of early voting in Florida that Governor Scott had reduced to only 8. Both bills could also increase the number of voting hours on each early voting day. Unfortunately, Republicans control both chambers of the state legislature, but incoming Republican leaders have suggested that they would be amenable to changing voting laws in Florida. So let's hope that's the case, so that every Floridian has the right to vote in upcoming elections. The bad. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. Despite insisting for months that he would not support a right-to-work-for-less law in his state, Snyder is doing just that. Today, Snyder called on the Michigan legislature to introduce and pass a right-to-work-for-less bill and said that he would sign it as soon as it reaches his desk. Snyder was one of several Republican governors who led an all-out assault on workers' rights in 2011. Michigan's neighbor, Indiana, passed a right-to-work-for-less law earlier this year, and Snyder says he wants to stay competitive with the Hoosier state. I guess he's willing to screw thousands of workers in the process. And the very, very ugly Walmart. Late last month, 100 workers died in a garment factory fire in Bangladesh. The plant, which made clothing for Walmart, among other companies, had no emergency exits or any type of evacuation plan. And now it turns out that in a meeting last year, Walmart brass refused to pay suppliers more money to make safety improvements at their manufacturing facilities. In a statement obtained by Bloomberg News, a Walmart official says, "We are talking about 4,500 factories, and in most cases, very extensive and costly modifications would need to be undertaken at some factories. It's not financially feasible for the brands to make such investments," end quote. Yeah, right. The world's largest corporation can't spare a fraction of its bottom line to improve safety conditions for its workers. The Bangladeshi deaths could have been totally avoided. But Walmart put corporate greed ahead of human safety, and that is very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. Robert, in Donalds, South Carolina, you have thoughts on secession, Donald.
Tom, how are you doing this evening?
Or Robert, excuse me. I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Same way, actually. I just got through eating some flounder. You hear my accent, so I'm not originally from South Carolina. However, okay. I do support the idea of secession, and here's why.
Okay.
The founders were secessionists. I think you agree with that.
Well, they seceded from England.
Exactly. When the King of England granted the freedom to all of the 13 colonies, have you ever read the Treaty of 1783?
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, in it, it's clear, and he named.
I'm making a note, though, to do so.
Well, that's. I'm not digging at you. Please accept what I'm saying is, you know.
No, I didn't think you were. I'm genuinely making a note to read it. I'm fascinated.
Good. If you get the original original document, which is hard to find, but you can find copies of it, the U in the United States is small. It's not capitalized, and there's a reason for that. They were united in a cause. There was no such thing as the United States of America. We agree then because the Constitution wasn't ratified till 1789. By who? 13 individual sovereign nations. Now, that's just a worldview. And if you disagree with that, that's okay. But
you know, well, let's say I don't disagree with that. I frankly don't know what to make of it. But let's say for a moment that originally when the 13 states seceded from England successfully with the Revolutionary War, you know, they were acknowledged as United States, and the word state was interpreted to mean nation state. And they functionally, and I think that there was a lot of sentiment at that time for that, frankly. I don't disagree with you on that. If you're familiar with the Articles of Confederation, they basically were articles of the Confederation of 13 independent states that operated largely as independent nation states. And it failed. Didn't work out. It was a disaster. Right. We had three presidents before George Washington. The country was falling apart. Commerce wasn't happening. We were in a Great Depression. Things were really going badly. And that's why in 1787 they got together to try to rewrite the Articles of Confederation and just said, finally, to hell with that. We're gonna create a whole brand new constitution, and we're gonna create a single country with 13 provinces or districts or states, which are not nation states. They are states. They will have some rights that will be preserved to them. In fact, quite a few. All the rights not specifically taken by the Constitution, as in the 10th Amendment.
Excuse me, Tom?
Yeah.
You there?
Yeah. I'm hearing you, but
hear you fine. But, okay. But just a second. Nowhere does that, any of what you just said, the last few sentences, no, that's not in the Constitution anywhere. The preamble of the Constitution says, we the people of the United States, in order to form what?
A more perfect union.
Exactly. Not a nation, not a country. A more perfect union.
Well, how is that not a nation?
Well, a union, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore.
Okay, well, the end of that sentence is, do ordain and establish this constitution for the United States of America, and U is capitalized,
Absolutely.
S is capitalized, and so is the A.
Absolutely. And in 1860, when the Southern states felt that the Lincoln administration was going to do harm to the compact, whether it be because of slavery, I'm not going to argue it wasn't about slavery. They did secede because they were afraid they were going to lose their means of income. I'm not going to lie about that. Or say, oh, the war wasn't about slavery. Folks argue that. I don't want to argue that.
Well,
We're talking about today. We're talking about people.
Right.
And, you know, you and I agree more than we disagree. We just don't see eye to eye on the United States.
But if you're arguing that the United States is not a country, I don't think you're going to find a lot of people saluting that flag.
Well, that's a horrible metaphor. I don't salute it. Hey, what about the folks in Washington who just passed, and good for them, this thing on marijuana? Hell, if they want to smoke pot, let them. I don't care.
In Washington State.
You know?
Right.
Huh?
In Washington State, yeah.
I promise you the federal government is going to injunct it in a federal court of appeals.
We'll see.
It's going to happen.
We'll see. I doubt it. But
we'll see. Is like you said, if the Republicans ran Ron Paul, he would have beat Obama. But that's here and there.
I don't think that's the case either. I think when people realize that Rand Paul wants to do away with Social Security and turn it over to his buddies on Wall Street.
I said Ron Paul.
Well, Ron Paul also wants to do away with Social Security and give it to his buddies on Wall Street. Okay.
Yeah.
But in any case, but rather than arguing the politics of this, I'm just fascinated. What is that your entire point, that we're not a country, that we're a union of voluntary states, and therefore those states should be able to secede?
It's part of what I'm saying. What I am saying is, and you talked about the right of association earlier, not wanting to associate with someone, say, from Connecticut, seeing that I'm from there, that's my free right. Now, if people in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and, say, I don't know, Rhode Island, want, I don't know, some crazy law like, let's say, the freedom to, you have to get rid of all your cars. That's just crazy, and I don't agree with that. But I'm just making a point. And we in here in South Carolina don't want that. Why do we have to go along with it?
Well,
and then they make it happen in the Congress.
Here's how it works. You elect representatives who represent your perspective. Those people go to Washington, D.C. and make the laws. If you feel that your representatives aren't representing you well, you throw the bums out and replace them with somebody who will.
Come on, Tom. That doesn't work, and you know it doesn't. Look at what's happened. Many of the things you say on your show, which is really, really a good show,
show that it's just not working.
I think it's working somewhat. My problem is not with that representative Democratic Republic part of it. It's the Supreme Court part of it, which was not part of what the founders came up with. Read Article 3, Section 2.
But it's already there, and they've done things on precedent. In fact, they've even said something. They tried to talk about secession, but they couldn't touch it. They tried to jail Jefferson Davis. They couldn't. They had nothing to try him on.
Right.
You know. And again, going back.
Well, and Lincoln and Johnson after him were having nothing to do with
slavery and race thing. Really, give it up.
Well, then what is it? Let me ask you then the same question I asked the last person. What rules would you, what laws would you have different in South Carolina if it was a separate nation than it has right now?
Okay, that's a good point. I believe Mr. Cushman spoke about property rights.
Yes.
You fallaciously believe you own your property. If anything,
so you do away with property taxes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I don't disagree with that.
I do away with income tax too.
So okay, how are you going to fund your schools and your roads and your public utilities?
This is where we probably have some disagreement. First of all, is higher education and medium education a function of the state? We want things smaller, not bigger. In government.
So you'd want to do away with the schools. And rich people who can afford to educate their kids can educate their kids, and people who are born poor.
See, this is what
I mean, you're getting into the area of the Lucky Sperm Club stuff, you know? If you're a member of the Lucky Sperm Club.
You're putting words in my mouth.
Okay.
As you did Michael's too. Don't do that with me.
All right.
Put words in my mouth. I never said that.
So
I said higher education. Okay, why are we paying for marching bands? Why are we paying for all that stuff? We can't afford
Well, we don't actually anymore. We used to pay 80% of the cost.
Show you the budget.
The governments used to pay 80% of the cost of education in the United States in the 1960s. Right now, they pay a little more than 20%. It has flipped.
Come on. Would you like me to send you my tax bill?
I mean, this is just a fact. This is why there's $1 trillion in student debt. Because the students are paying for most of college.
Why do we want to be separate? And here's why.
Because you don't want any
certain things. We're being forced to do certain things, which, by the way, is not.
You're being forced to educate your people.
If you think it's free, doesn't mean I do.
Right. So that's where you would draw the line, is that you don't think the public education should be there.
See, I never said that. I said higher education.
Okay. Then you. All right. Okay, Robert. Thank you for the call. I'll think about it. I'm not gonna trash you when you're not here to defend yourself. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is a fascinating topic, and what's most fascinating about it is that a quarter of the Republican Party takes it seriously. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Harry in Estaboga, Alabama. Am I saying that right, Harry?
Yes, sir.
Hey, thank you for calling. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. You wanted to weigh in on secession.
Yes, sir. The thing about it is that I noticed everybody is, you know, even in the state of Alabama, they're so angry that the president won his reelection. But it was a great country when we had all the other presidents. But now that we have President Obama, everybody upset and want to leave, but it's sad that they think that way. And when we have our next election, they want us to respect president and respect the office. But all these so-called people that want to succeed, I don't think it's right for a senator that talk like that to run for public office or hold any federal office.
Mm-hmm.
And those people that signing those petitions, I think they don't even need to have a right to vote in this country.
So is your point that the secessionists never really got any traction until we had an African American in the White House?
Yeah.
Okay. Yesterday, my wife Louise and a friend of ours, I don't know if she wants her name said on TV, so I'm not going to say it, but who's African American, went together to into the United States Senate. and the whole long, you know, thing about the reason why. But the point is that Louise and this friend of ours were, while we were on the air, were standing in the Senate, and here's all these pictures of all these white men. And Louise, her first observation was, there's no women, you know, in these historic pictures, right? All the senators going back to the founding of the country. And her friend's comment was, and there's no people of color either. And which is, makes it, you know, a double whammy. She said, when I bring my daughter in here and show her around, it's like, you know, yeah, I get it, Harry. I think that there is a racial subtext to a lot of this, and there is a lot of, you know, white, racist, you know, how dare there be a black man in our White House kind of stuff going on. I think that some of that is around the margins and some of it is right at the core of secession. And then I think that there are probably some secessionists who are not doing it at all, who are not even thinking about it in terms of race. But it often seems to come back to that. I think you're absolutely right. Harry, thank you for the call. John in Greenwich, New Jersey. Hey, John, you're a Republican?
Yes, I am.
And you're rational?
Yes, I am. That's what I was wondering, if you had some sort of litmus test. I think I am, but when I listen to this, I'm beginning to wonder.
Do you think that global warming is caused by humans?
I think we're partly responsible, but I think there is evidence that the temperature of the Earth does cycle over the, you know,
oh, of course it
years.
Does. Of course it does, yeah, but not in the ways
and
that
I
we're seeing right now.
And I hear so much now that we're actually in a cooling trend.
Well, we have been part of one for several thousand years, tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
But that's...
No, I do believe we are partly responsible, yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, the irrational Republicans that I've been pointing out are people who deny global climate change, which is clearly very real and very destructive to us. The people who say that the UN is going to come and take, you know, Rick Santorum saying that the UN is going to take his 4-year-old daughter off and force her to be killed. Does that make any sense to you, John?
Yeah.
It does make
sense? It did, actually.
Really? Why? I mean, the UN can't even go into North Sudan and take out Bashir, you know, the guy that they indicted as a war criminal. They just don't do that.
No.
So you think they're going to come and take away your 4-year-old kid because she's got a congenital illness?
No, I don't agree with any of that.
Okay.
No, I don't.
So then,
I think we've given in too much. I'm not completely in favor of everything the UN does. Don't get me wrong there. But when going back to that global warming thing, I think we're putting ourselves behind the eight ball because we have the technology, like in the coal industry. We could burn coal cleaner than anybody else, but with us not burning coal, we feel good about ourselves, but yet we're exporting coal at a record rate so they can burn it in other parts of the world and that would cause greater pollution than we would if we were burning it ourselves.
That's true.
You know, out of sight, out of mind.
That's true.
We feel better about it.
Yeah, that's true. And it's the same point that I make about, you know, the Bangladeshis who are working for Walmart who died in the factory. It's like we have slaves now here in the United States. It's just that they're not in the United States. They're in Bangladesh. And therefore we don't care about them so much. But I would say that burning coal anywhere is adding, I mean, we're adding 2.4 million pounds of carbon into the atmosphere every second of every minute of every hour of every day. And that is producing a consequence for this earth. But John, if you consider yourself a rational Republican, I would like to ask you, just, you know, person to person, if you would please start getting active in the Republican Party, because there's crazy people who've taken your party.
Oh no, I agree. I mean, I would love to see the Speaker of the House gone. I was sorry to see Jim DeMint. I don't know how you feel about him.
I think he's a crazy person.
I thought he was a more rational Republican myself.
Okay.
Do you agree or not?
No, I don't. I strongly disagree with Jim DeMint. Jim DeMint, you know,
Well, this is one reason. Are we on course to take in a record amount of tax this year?
No, actually, tax collections are at a low. They haven't been this low since the Eisenhower administration.
The collection or the money due? I mean, the actual money that's supposed to come in.
I don't think that there's that big a number between the two.
You don't?
No, no. The IRS is pretty efficient these days. But John, I got to move. We got to wrap up the show. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Good and nice to know there's a rational Republican out there, even if you do like Jim DeMette. Next on the Tom Hartman program tomorrow. Sobriety, that means brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about the important issues of the week and taking your calls too. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. What's on your mind? And the best of the rest of the news along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active. Like I said to our last caller, you know, get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.